warm welcome to all our Campus FM listeners today. This series is entitled Back in Time. The episodes will discuss broad themes associated with the study of archaeology, and through them, we shall try to understand why these various fields are really significant in the exploration of the past. Before I introduce today's guest, I'd like to mention that this program is being recorded on Zoom. So if you hear a few noises off, you'll know what it's all about. So helping us in our explorations today is Eleanor Sherry, who is Professor of Evolutionary Archaeology. Professor Sherry works at the Max Planck Institute for the Science of Human History in Germany, where she is the head of the Pan-African Evolution Research Group. And she's also an associate professor at the University of Malta. Welcome, and thank you, Eleanor, if I may, for accepting to come on the program to talk to us about the importance of evolutionary studies within the field of archaeology. Another huge subject. However, I'm sure that you will manage to give us a good outline, even within our limited time frame. So, on with my first query, a pretty basic question which could take an hour, but unfortunately we don't have an hour. So what do we know about the origins of our species?
Okay, well, first of all, thank you for inviting me onto this program. I'm thrilled to be able to talk about what we know and also a little bit about how my research articulates with this. Our species evolved in Africa and from there went on to inhabit the rest of the Earth. We know this because the earliest fossils carrying the physical traits that define us today are found in Africa from around 300,000 years ago. We also know that we originate in Africa from genetic evidence. And this is because the genetic diversity of all non-African populations today is nested within the greater variation of contemporary African populations. And this shows that humanity's deepest roots lie in Africa, because the greater the genetic variation, the older the roots, because that population has had longer to diversify. But there is a small plot twist. When humans began to leave Africa, they encountered native Eurasian species such as Neanderthals and their eastern cousins, who we refer to as the Denisovans. There was some limited gene flow between these populations, such that a small percentage of the contemporary Eurasian genome is derived from these other hominin populations. The genes we inherited from them tend to focus on immunities, perhaps to native Eurasian diseases. Also, for example, contemporary Tibetan people seem to have got their high altitude adaptation genes from Denisovans. But not all the genes we inherited from them were good either. A recent paper suggested that a higher proportion of Neanderthal ancestry makes you more susceptible to COVID-19 and other diseases such as Crohn's disease, heart disease, and also autoimmune diseases like lupus. So while the wellspring of our species is Africa, contemporary populations, including some in Africa, thanks to back migrations, have a small amount of DNA that comes from other hominin populations who are not Homo sapiens like us. So we originate in Africa. And since we originate in Africa, many of the things we associate with the state of being human are found there. So features such as art, complex and abstract thinking, social networking, social signaling, and the alteration and exploitation of different environments, from rainforests to desert edges. People lived in small, networked kin groups of hunter-gatherers, which were spread across most, if not all, of Africa. Although different, early human populations looked very different to one another, because physical diversity was much higher then, their material culture is really comparable. And this shows that the earliest manifestations of our species were primarily cognitive and behavioural.
That's fascinating. I've been reading quite a bit about the Denisovans and Neanderthals recently, and is this quite new research, that this connection between the contemporary species and the African for people who are moving into Europe?
Yes, I mean, we've known about Neanderthals quite a long time, although we didn't fully understand our relationship with them. For example, in the beginning, people thought they were our ancestors, and then it was close evolutionary cousins with whom we didn't exchange any genes. The Nissevens are a much more recent discovery. This is coming from research in the last 10 years, which is pretty sensational. And from ancient DNA, we now know that humans exchange genes with Neanderthals and Denisovans, but also that Denisovans and Neanderthals exchange genes with each other. There was a recent paper that was extremely interesting where they found actually a first generation hybrid from a cave in Siberia, Denisova cave itself, where the ancient DNA was first found. And this individual, who was an eight-year-old girl, or roughly an eight-year-old girl, had one Neanderthal parent and one Denisovan parent. So to find a first-generation hybrid is like gold dust. It was an incredible discovery.
Of course. Great for the researcher. Well, that's a very nice segue, in fact, to my next question, because we've been talking about DNA. How do we know these things about this evolutionary development?
So I would say that the field of human origins is broadly divided between the study of material culture, the study of bones and fossils, the study of ancient DNA, and the study of paleoecology. So in other words, different groups of scientists explore how people behaved, what they looked like, and what their ancestry was, and what their environments were like. And in my work, I combine most of these aspects to ask questions about human evolution. Each of them tells us something that's related to the overall story, although each line of evidence tells us something individual about that story as well, and I'll explain. Developments in ancient DNA, specifically the sequencing of Neanderthal and Denisovan DNA, shed light on when the lineage leading to humans today split off from the lineages that led to Neanderthals and Denisovans. So in other words, when we all had a common ancestor. And that time was around 1 million years ago to around 700,000 years ago. And these insights were possible because Neanderthals and Denisovan populations lived in parts of northern Eurasia that are very cold. And this acts like a fridge or even a freezer for the preservation of ancient DNA. Whereas in Africa, we have a hot and often a wet environment where increased DNA preservation is not very good. So ancient DNA from our northern Eurasian cousins sheds light on the timeline of our evolution. If the lineage leading to us split off from the other lineages around 1 million to 700,000 years ago, the earliest individuals that begin to look and behave like us emerged around 300,000 years ago. And we know this from two lines of evidence. First, studies of contemporary human DNA can estimate a point of common origin for all living humans. But more precisely, we now have ancient fossils from Africa that feature among the earliest physical traits of contemporary people. And these fossils come from several African regions, showing that we emerged from within a complex set of subdivided populations living across the continent. And over time, gene flow between these groups led to the fixing of the physical traits that define us today, which include, for example, a globular brain case, a small face, and a chin. If the physical or morphological features take some time to crystallize into what we recognize in ourselves today, the behavioral traits also emerge around 300,000 years ago. So prior to this time, hominins, so that's the evolutionary group that includes ourselves, our ancestors, and our extinct relatives, such as Neanderthals, well, they made stone tools by taking a block of raw material and shaping it to something resembling an axe. These so-called hand axes seem to have been multi-purpose tools that are found all over the place. The flakes of stone they took off the block of raw material were discarded as waste. Shortly before 300,000 years ago, this flipped. People took the flakes of stone as the tools and they discarded the block when they had finished taking flakes of stone off it. They began to shape the block of raw material in particular ways in order to be able to detach stone flakes of a predetermined shape and size, which shows planning depth and mental schemes and templates. They then take these flakes of stone and shape them into an impressive array of different forms not seen in the archaeological record before, They made, for example, pointed triangular shapes for hunting. They made blunted straight-edged flakes for scraping hides. They made notched flakes for whittling down wood. And they also modified the base of their stone tools in order to insert them into wooden hafts, handles, and spear shafts. They attached wooden hafts to stone tips using animal and plant fibers, bindings, and resins. So in other words, they're combining materials not found together in nature, each of which has been prepared in a special way, indicating forms of social cohesion. They also begin to transport particular good raw materials, such as obsidian or volcanic glass, for very long distances, indicating the presence of exchange networks. We also see the emergence of personal ornamentation during this time in the form of intentionally perforated shell beads or sometimes stained with dyes such as ochre. And a little later, we see the emergence of innovations that increasingly allowed early members of our species to control and overcome their environments. So in the archaeological record, we see, for example, water storage technology emerge in the form of portable ostrich egg containers. We see evidence of the widespread burning of large areas of land, the exploitation of very broad and varied diets, and we see human influence on the composition and extent of different animal communities. So when we think about pristine environments today, almost nothing is pristine. Almost everything has been shaped by humans for a very, very long time. And later on still, we see early members of our species shallow mining for preferred raw materials and the clear collection of wild seeds that may suggest that people were planting preferred flora and influencing the location and abundance of different plant types long before agriculture emerged.
Well, it's very interesting to try and understand, or from what you're saying, really understand that there was this real sophistication at that time. And the link between the sophistication of the Neanderthal group and other groups, is it now thought that they run in parallel or...?
Yes, very much so. The dominant theory in the past used to be about brain development and cognition, and there was this idea that we were somehow more cognitively advanced than Neanderthals. But since that time, there's been a lot of research on demography and the effects of population size and population density on the efflorescence of material culture, the spread of innovations, the likelihood of innovations. And you know, we can see that the disparity that's seen between Neanderthals and early modern humans in Africa is probably a function of population size, that we had a larger overall population size, and this led to more innovations, more exchanges. But currently, I think, broadly, we don't see a huge difference between the cognitive capacity of Neanderthals and ourselves.
Before we move on, because there are lots of other things to discuss, looking at the timeline of human evolution, 300,000 years ago seems really like yesterday.
Yes.
there's this huge 5 million years sort of going, when you talk about human evolution, the very, 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 very beginnings of it, and it took millions of years. But then everything seems to speed up after that.
I think part of it is the types of terminology we use. So we talk about species, but species concepts is a really thorny issue. The ways that there are about, I don't know, over 50 different species concepts, each emphasizing a different necessary trait for a group to be classed or ranked as a species. And it seems likely to me that Homo sapiens, Neanderthals and Denisovans were variants of the same species rather than completely different species. And they were certainly at the edge of being able to interbreed. There have been, you know, studies suggesting that male offspring were not fertile, and that's why no living human male has a Y chromosome that comes from a Neanderthal group. But female offspring were able to reproduce, so there might be sort of these asynchronous patterns of interbreeding, perhaps because, you know, we were definitely evolving along separate trajectories, and given more time, that interbreeding may no longer have been possible. But generally, you're looking for something in the order of 1 million years for a species to really separate. So as you point out, 300,000 years is nothing. Even the separation time may have begun as recently as 500,000 years ago. you know, we think it's between 1 million and 700, but it could have been as early as 500,000 years ago. And when you think back and think the ancestors of chimpanzees and the ancestors of humans split between 6 and 8 million years ago, you know, this sort of shows you how recent human origins are and how this really articulates with the species debate. You know, are Neanderthals a different species or are they merely individuals evolving along a separate evolutionary trajectory but could still broadly be classed as the same species?
What about the question of us having this 1% Neanderthal in our DNA?
Well, that's all to do with how we left Africa and how we colonized the rest of the world.
Well, that's that was, again, a very nice segue, unintentional on my part, to my next question, which was, how did we end up leaving Africa and colonizing the rest of the world?
So, you know, as I've just been explaining, our species originate in Africa. But what's really interesting is that various early human groups seem to have managed to leave that continent several times. So the Sahara Desert, which forms part of the Saharo-Arabian Arid Belt, and this actually stretches all the way to the Thar Desert of eastern India. And this would have spread across the whole region, forming an impenetrable barrier when it was dry. And this may even have contributed to the splitting off of our lineage with the last common ancestor with Neanderthals and Denisovans. But the Sahara Desert barrier was periodically weakened. So about every 100,000 years or so, various orbital parameters, such as the tilt of the Earth and its orbit, shift a little bit, which has the effect of melting ice in the north and moving the intertropical convergence zone in Africa northwards. So this is today the equatorial region where tropical northeast and southeast trade winds meet. And the effect of this is to bring a greater degree of rainfall and warmth to regions such as North Africa, which meant that lakes and rivers expanded into what is today hyper-arid desert. Now, these relatively brief windows meant that people could follow game and water courses across regions that spread beyond Africa. And we know that they did this at least the first time around, or at least up to 270,000 years ago. So this is a time when we were sort of just barely becoming Homo sapiens. A group of early humans left Africa and met groups of Neanderthals in Europe and exchanged genes with them. And the traces of that exchange are not found within anyone living today, but they are instead found within Neanderthal DNA itself. And this shows that this early population only left descendants among Neanderthal populations that went extinct, essentially in unmixed form. They got absorbed into Neanderthal populations in Europe. Next, controversial early fossils found in Greece and Israel suggest there may have been another migration out of Africa around 170,000 years ago that left no trace among anyone living today. It seems to have happened again around 125,000 years ago, where there was a major greening event across the Saharo-Arabian Arid Belt. Populations moved into Southwest Asia, living in today's Israel, parts of Jordan and Saudi Arabia. And some of these populations seem to have moved even further east. So a sensational paper in Nature, I think it was in 2020, reported that in the tropical forests of Southeast Asia, human teeth dating to around 70,000 years ago were found. However, it seems that despite these early successes, these first Eurasian human populations did not last. And we don't know why. But nobody living today is descended from them. Instead, patterns or variation in contemporary Eurasian populations indicate that we all descend, so everyone living in Eurasia today can trace their ancestry back to a group that left Africa around 60,000 years ago. Could be a little earlier, could be a little later. But this was not a time when the desert had shrunk. Instead, it's actually quite a dry period. And so we can contrast this dispersal to earlier dispersals, which can be correlated with a wetter Sahara-Arabian Arid Belt. Now, we don't know what was so special about this later dispersal in that it led to all living Eurasian populations. My research suggests that just before the successful out of Africa migration, people had learned to exploit very diverse ecosystems, a process that perhaps gave them the flexibility to cope with different environments beyond Africa. And genetic exchanges with Neanderthals and Denisovans shortly after leaving Africa may also have helped these early Eurasian ancestors to cope with conditions on a different continent, from perhaps getting used to far colder environments and less sunlight, to coping with new diseases. So, you know, there are studies that suggest that mixing with Neanderthals affected everything from skin pigmentation to how we cope with particular diseases in a positive and a negative way. So it's probably a mixture of these things as to why this dispersal 60,000 years ago was successful. And, you know, perhaps in future we might find that new technologies played a role as well. Technology such as bow and arrow technology that spelled out the success of the migration of essentially a really small group of our species that left Africa around 60,000 years ago, but whom all non-Africans even today can trace their descent.
It's an interesting idea, this second, third, fourth, fifth wave of out of Africa. Interesting to see the different reasons as to why that might have happened. A question which I suppose we ask ourselves, really, is why are we the last hominin species left on the planet?
Why were
we so successful?
Yes. We're indeed the last representative of the hominin evolutionary group that in the past always included several contemporary species. So when we used to study human origins in the past, famous studies in the 19th and early 20th century, we always had this very linear view of one species replacing the next. And this is because we thought that to be the only hominin species on the planet was, you know, the sort of way that it always was. But actually, we've since found out that we are the anomalies. In the past, there are always several hominin populations or species living alongside each other. And we are in an actually really anomalous situation, which we are the only ones left. Early members of our species from 300,000 years ago shared their world with other hominins. So it wasn't always like this. Our ancestors knew other hominins, and we can only imagine what it would have been like to face another form of humanity. In Africa, the last members of Homo heidelbergensis and Homo naledi, now extinct, live alongside the first Homo sapiens. So dates from the last from Homo heidelbergensis, for example, which was another large-brained hominin that may even have been ancestral to Neanderthals, they disappeared like shortly after 300,000 years ago. So there was some period of overlap. When Homo sapiens moved into Eurasia, they met Neanderthals and Denisovans and exchanged genes with them. And one question that remains is, you know, did we exchange genes with the last African hominins as well? So was that kind of gene flow also going on in Africa? So why are the only ones left? So it seems likely that throughout the history of hominins, the overall population size was never very large. So paleontologists looking at really early paleontological sites in both Africa and Eurasia, so this is way back before the emergence of our own species, so we're looking at Homo erectus and earlier hominin species, they always seem to show quite a low abundance compared to fossils of other species such as antelopes or other carnivores. It always seemed to be very few of them around if you just compare the abundance of different fossils of different species. And it seems likely that Homo sapiens formed the largest overall population size of hominins in the history of hominins. So I think we could say that overall, you know, from the Australopithecines onwards, population sizes were quite small until we got to Homo sapiens. And this didn't happen at once, so it seems clear that the very first Homo sapiens were not particularly abundant either. However, there are several indicators of growth from around 120,000 years ago, which was a period of particularly good climate condition in Africa. So we see a significant expansion of archaeological sites during this time, as well as the diversification of material culture, indicating the spread of new ideas. And we know from different studies that this requires a larger population size to achieve. So the larger the population size and denser the population, the more ideas you'll get and the more those ideas will be copied with high fidelity. Meanwhile, Eurasian hominins such as Neanderthals and Denisovans had to deal with ice ages because they just happened to live in the northern latitudes. Ice ages in Africa means dry period, so there's never any ice there. But these shifts only really affect the northern part of Africa. Sub-Saharan Africa was primarily governed by different systems regulating climate. And we just published a paper about this year. In contrast, during ice ages, much of Europe and northern Asia was covered by ice sheets. And even beyond these ice sheets, winters would have been brutal and living extremely hard. And we even see this in the bones and fossils of Neanderthals, that they lived incredibly hard lives. Neanderthal and Denisovan population sizes seem to have been much smaller than those of modern humans, ourselves, essentially. You know, this could also be that they might even have had a tiny increased rate of infant mortality over several thousands of years. This would have had a radical effect on overall population size. And there are also indications of severe inbreeding. For example, one Neanderthal individual whose ancient DNA was recovered had parents who were either siblings or an uncle and a niece or an aunt and a nephew. Other genetic studies on Neanderthals have indicated a collapse in genetic diversity around the time of the last ice age, which probably signifies an overall population collapse. So I think the answer why we're the only hominin around today is random potluck. Our species evolved away from the ice in better overall conditions with a larger landmass of available habitat to expand into. We probably outcompeted any surviving African hominins, but our sister species or variants of the same species, Neanderthals and Denisovans, our evolutionary first cousins, if you like, there wasn't a lot of difference between us in terms of our capabilities, as we've discussed. I think they just had the bad luck of evolving in Eurasia. But there's a twist here as well, and it's something that you sort of raised a little bit a few moments ago. We exchanged genes with Neanderthals as well as Denisovans when we entered into Eurasia. Although the period of interbreeding was brief, it probably happened several times, as there are different fragments of Neanderthal DNA, and these are varied. So this means that although on average Eurasians have something between 1.5 to 2% Neanderthal DNA, that 2% can be really different from one individual to the next. And if you gather those fragments and you add them together, then something like 20% of the Neanderthal genome survives in us. And I think this raises some philosophical questions about what it means to go extinct.
Well, yes, food for thought there. I'm hoping to squeeze in very quickly a final question. When you look at the fossil record, what did we look like? And really, how did we live, actually?
Yeah, so we actually look startlingly different to each other at first, more different than any two populations you could think of today. Yet our material culture was all broadly comparable in that we all lived in very similar ways. All early humans were hunter-gatherers, which meant that at times they hunted animals, and other times they gathered wild food such as tubers, nuts, berries, and fruit. And apart from hunting, they probably also trapped small animals. So you probably shouldn't imagine big game hunting was a daily occurrence of the kind that you see in these sort of dioramas of prehistoric life. And they largely lived in rock shelters and makeshift huts. They didn't live in deep, dark, damp caves, although they used these locations for various purposes. In warm places like Africa, life was certainly largely lived in the open air, as you can see with African hunter-gatherers today. Further north, there is evidence of people living in rock shelters that probably had makeshift tents attached, made from skins and furs. And later, there's evidence that people were making tents or huts framed by mammoth bones. People probably lived in relatively small kin groups, and were part of larger related populations in different regions. So they would have been able to call on each other to help when times were difficult, and they would have periodically met to encourage exchanges and marriages, or whatever we want to call it back then. They would also have had spiritual beliefs and rituals, and there's evidence of this from across Africa and Eurasia in the form of statuettes, cave paintings, rock art, ornamentation, and pigment use, possibly for body painting. And they lived their lives according to the rhythms of nature, reproducing the same culture over thousands of years, which is something really unimaginable to us, where, you know, everything changes every decade almost. These were people who were not locked in history as we are. Their perception of time and existence would have been fundamentally different to our own. And to me, studying them makes me understand my own humanity better.
Well, unfortunately, we really, really have run out of time now, and I shall have to close this extremely interesting discussion. I'd like to thank Professor Eleanor Sherry for being with us, and I hope that our listeners will join me again next week, where we shall be tackling another important theme in the field of archaeology. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.